I don't know why I'm surprised anymore, why God and his providence puts words and phrases and thoughts in my sermon that are in songs that we sing, not just throughout the morning, but literally right before I come up here to share from God's word. I don't know if you thought as deeply as you can about what we just sang. In particular, I want you to think about the words to the second stanza. This is so rich. I mean, this frames life. I mean, this frames like every circumstance of difficulty you and I can possibly fathom. So this is what we just sang. Whatever my God ordains is right, he, that is of course God, will never deceive me. He leads me by the proper path. I know he will not leave me. I take content what he has sent. His hand can turn my griefs away, and patiently I wait his day. And then in the next verse, maybe it's not the next verse, it's the last verse. Whatever my God ordains is right, here shall my stand be taken. Though sorrow, need, and or death be mine, yet I am not forsaken. His Father's care is round me there. He holds me that I shall not fall, and so to him I leave it all. You could re-paraphrase or re-word. It wouldn't sound good to sing it this way because it doesn't rhyme, but you could paraphrase that last part, and so to him I'll trust him. So since whatever God's ordaining in life is right, we can trust him. Because he's always been faithful, he never deceives. He's not out to hurt us or harm us or break us, but to care for us, to walk with us, as the psalmist says in Psalm 23, through even the valley of the shadow of death. Is there any reason that you and I can think of this morning that he's not trustworthy? That when something disrupts our life, that he isn't somehow doing 1,000 things at that moment to sanctify us? He is trustworthy. This is such a rich theme of the Christian life, to think about trusting God. And we're going to talk about that this morning from Psalm chapter 125. So if you have your Bible, I want to invite you to turn there. Psalm 125, it's just 5 verses long. It's a fairly brief psalm. And I want to help you think through a little bit of a practical question this morning, because admittedly, when you talk about trusting God, a lot of times that phrase can sound a little cliche. It can sound a little bit like, oh, I expect you to say that. That's what Christians are supposed to say when things are hard. Just trust God. Maybe it's the first piece of counsel you tend to get when you reach out to a Christian brother or sister and you're having a hard time. They say, well, just trust God. It can be cliche. It's certainly not supposed to be. But my goal and aim from Psalm 125 this morning is to put some feet to that fire, to put some application to the idea of what it means to trust God and what it looks like. And I want to start by talking about Patrick, St. Patrick in particular. There are so many good examples in church history of people who exhibited a trust in God that is worthy of emulation. St. Patrick is one of these individuals. He was originally from Rome, not Ireland. He ministered and preached to the people in Ireland in the 4th and then into the 5th centuries, if you don't know much about him. He was captured at the age of 16 by Irish pirates, and he was forced into slavery. He became a slave for about 6 years among them. And during that time, and then as his time came to an end, he was thinking more and more about the need for the gospel in Ireland, which is where he eventually would end up. And he basically felt compelled, he felt God called him to preach and take the gospel to Ireland. That time in history, Ireland was a very undeveloped country, had many uncivilized peoples and groups and tribes. It was a very hostile place, not just to domesticated men and women, but just to the gospel at large. But he went there anyway because that's where God called him to be. One historian remarked about Patrick's influence in this country. He said, as the Roman lands went from peace to chaos, the land of Ireland, he says, was rushing even more rapidly from chaos to peace because of the gospel. So Patrick trusted God. He had an immense trust in God that because God had called him, or if I could use the words of the song we just sang, because God ordained him to go, and that's the right thing for him to do, he trusted God. And we have an example preserved of this trust. It appears on something that is referred to now as the breastplate of St. Patrick. It's a prayer. It reads a little bit like a mission statement. It is from him, probably from his words, a little bit like a life purpose. I want to read you just a portion of this prayer of St. Patrick. He wrote, "I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak for me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me, God's house to save me from snares of devils, from temptations of vices, from everyone who shall wise me ill. Christ to shield me today against poison, against burning, against drowning, against wounding, so that there may come to me abundance of reward." And then you might have heard this from him: "Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right, Christ in my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit down, Christ when I arise. I arise today through a mighty strength." That is trusting God. That is an expression of knowing that what God has ordained is right. Without fear, going to a hostile place, as countless missionaries have done throughout the history of the world, to preach the gospel. You don't do that unless you trust God. And while I haven't read anything directly from St. Patrick and Psalm 125, I am very confident that the truths of Psalm 125 are the kinds of truths that compel men like him to preach the gospel in places like this. So in Psalm 125, I want to remind you of just a few things about this portion of the Psalms. If you were here last Sunday, I introduced to you, or maybe reintroduced to you, a grouping of Psalms called the Psalms of Ascent. They are, I'm going to make a correction that I misspoke last week, Psalm 120 to Psalm 134. There are 15 Psalms of Ascent. And these were Psalms that were sung by Jews as they made their way on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, probably for festivals in particular. They were meant to comfort them as they journeyed, encourage them as they made their way, inspire them as they went to God's holy city to worship and make a variety of sacrifices. So this song in particular is a song of trust, which would be a great thing to be meditating and singing about as you took maybe a perilous journey or a dangerous journey or a journey that went through the canyons or valleys where there might be predators and robbers and people meant for ill will for you and your family. It would be a good time to think about the importance of trusting God. We don't really know who wrote this psalm. There are many who suggest it was written during the days of Ezra or Nehemiah, or maybe that time period in general. And if that is the case, that we can come up with some really good reasons why the theme of trusting God would be good for that time period, because this was a group that had just got out of captivity in Babylon for 70 years, where their houses were wiped out, their temple was wiped out, their city was wiped out. Now they're back in town rebuilding, although albeit slowly, as we learned when we were in Haggai. But they are need to trust God again, a God who allowed them to be judged by Babylon, a God who allowed them to suffer for 7 decades, some of them dying in Babylon, some children being raised Jewishly in Babylon, now back home. There'd be a need to trust God. So that makes a little bit of sense why it could be that. But of course, pick a period of time in history, and there's always a need for learning to trust God. It's going to be impossible for me to preach on trusting God and not refer to Jerry Bridges, because he is, at least outside the Bible, the author who has written the book on trusting God. It is simply called Trusting God. And he says quite simply in his book, and we're going to come back to the context of this quote at the end, that our first priority in times of adversity is to honor and glorify God by trusting him. That is going to be really the takeaway, the major takeaway this morning is just that. That our most tangible expression in those times of adversity is trusting God. It is not an empty cliche to say trust God. It has action to it. There is evidence in our life that we are trusting God, and the most clear evidence that I can think of in the scriptures, in the Christian life, that you and I are trusting God is prayer. I can't think of anything more clear in the Bible or in the practice of the Christian life than prayer being a tangible expression or tangible evidence that we trust God. It really doesn't even matter what you're saying in prayer, because just think about the act of prayer for a moment. When you pray, what are you doing? You and I are admitting, I don't know what to do. I don't know who to talk to. I don't know how to feel about this. I don't even know what kinds of petitions to make. I'm just going to begin talking to you, God, my creator. That is evidence of trust, because we're showing our limitations, our finiteness, our inability to do something about whatever it is we are praying with. It is a declaration of dependence. That's what prayer is. So the key point is going to be simply that trusting God is proven by praying to God. And we're not going to show you this in every verse. I'm just going to tell you that's the whole thing. That's the whole example of the psalm. The psalm is a prayer. It's a psalm about trusting God, but it is a prayer. And so it just shows us, just by simply reading it, that the way we show our exemplify our own trust in God is by praying to God. So let me just make it a little bit practical. We'll jump back into some of these areas in a little bit. But if you are here this morning and you really struggle with something like anxiety or worry or fear, it's very likely you don't pray as often as you should. And the opposite is also true. If you have a very vibrant, active prayer life where you are talking to God on a regular basis, and we're talking like meditating and thinking through the day and speaking with him, it's very likely that things like anxiety, worry, and fear are not as paralyzing as they could be. Charles Spurgeon said, "Faith, when she is active and observant, finds illustrations of her own blessedness all around." In other words, trusting God, when it is active, has proof. And that proof is prayer. So I just want to encourage you. I'm going to give you an exhortation now that's probably meant for an application and a conclusion. But I'm going to just tell you right now, I'm going to give you an application. Do not settle as a Christian for taking what the world tells you to take or to do to de-stress your life. Because you will keep coming back to that over and over again because it doesn't work. That you and I as Christians are not meant to take the world's advice and counsel for how to remove anxiety and fear. So the world will tell us to do what? Keep drinking a few more beers, right? Get drunk this weekend. Play video games all night long. Watch that Netflix series that you've been wanting to binge and just spend a day in front of the television and just forget about the troubles of life. Those are worldly pieces of counsel, and those are not sanctifying means of dealing with stress. And if you do that on a regular basis, you probably do that on a regular basis because they don't work. It's just like the drunkard who keeps thinking, if I just take one more drink, it'll help, and it doesn't help, right? It's a cycle. We are not designed to deal with real heart issues like fear and worry and anxiety with worldly means. We are designed for something much better. And that much better is prayer. That's Psalm 125. So let's look at these verses together. I'm going to give you a pretty simple outline to follow along. And these different points along the way are going to just, again, show us evidences of trusting God. Show us byproducts or things that are outworkings of someone who is praying regularly to God when anxious, for example. And the first thing we're going to notice is really most of the psalm. We're going to think a little bit about the word stability. Trusting God results in a stable life. That's verses 1 to 3. The heading of in verse 1, the very first phrase of verse 1, it gives us the theme of the psalm, as I've already said. We are talking about those who are trusting the Lord. And the psalmist says, those who are trusting in the Lord are like Mount Zion. And then he says and describes about Mount Zion that it's a place that can't be moved, but abides forever. It's stable. It's immovable. The word trust means to attach yourself to, or to confide yourself to, or to feel safe, or to rely upon something. So trusting God what we mean by that is it means relying on him. It means attaching yourself to him and him alone. So it means that all the other things that are out there that tempt us to trust in them, like cities, fortresses, militaries, politics, government, legislation, laws, other men, all these other things that are tempting to trust work against this idea of trusting God and God alone. Only God is worthy of trust. He's the only one that we would say is omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. Charles Spurgeon again said, to trust elsewhere is vanity, and the more implicit such misplaced trust becomes, the more bitter will be the ensuing disappointment. In other words, if you keep turning away from God to trust, you'll continually be disappointed. But to trust in the living God is sanctified common sense, which needs no excuse. Its result shall be its best vindication. Maybe you know Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Those are verses that are very early memorized very often in the church. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. So with every part of your being, God and God alone, do not lean on your own understanding. Don't look to your own ideas, devices. In all your ways, acknowledge him. In all your ways, point out that he's worthy of trust. He will make straight your paths. Want to know how to make a decision? There it is. There's decision-making 101 counsel from the wisest person in the Bible. Just trust God. Just call out to God. He will make your paths straight. Now, the image here in verse 1 of Mount Zion is a strong image. It's going to carry over a little bit into verse 2 in just a few moments. He says, Mount Zion is a place that cannot be moved. It abides forever. Mount Zion, you probably know, often refers to a literal location. Sometimes it refers to the city of Jerusalem, or sometimes even really just the area around it, or even the place the temple would be sitting upon. It's an emblem, though, of permanence, of stability, of stable force. So that, again, remember how in this Psalms of Ascent grouping, these are, again, psalms written for pilgrims who are journeying somewhere. They're going to Mount Zion. And how frustrating would that be if you're on a journey and your GPS that you used in the Old Testament took you to a location, and that location was not there. See, the pilgrim going to Jerusalem would know, and he could depend on, that when he crossed that one last hill, there is Mount Zion. There is stability. There's permanence. It's going to be there. I can depend on it. The psalmist says it cannot be moved. It cannot be turned aside. That is a good image of what it means to trust God. To trust God means we're not turned aside and we're not swayed, we're not persuaded, we're not enticed or lured or kidnapped or beaten down or destroyed by what the world's going to say, this is where you need to cast your trust. Trusting God is about stability. One of the phrases that you hear often Christians say that I reject biblically, I reject doctrinally, is the phrase, I'm broken. You are before Christ, but after Christ you're not. You're healed. You're not only healed, but you're put under the care of one who is omnipotent. That ought to create a mindset of stability, just as we just sang, that whenever we see God ordaining things in life, that we know them to be right things. So whatever the circumstance might be, whatever the disruption could be, and the temptation to be anxious, the psalmist says that is when we turn our attention and our focus and our trust to God. That's when we begin praying to God, and he will give us a stable place to be. Sometimes, and we're all this way, sometimes we can get so flighty, dramatic, and kind of non-trusting, and kind of think that everything that happens is this big ordeal. The psalmist says those who trust are stable. They're even keel. You know, there are things that are greatly sad and greatly joyful, greatly happy. But a God truster, not like a child, as Paul says, tossed to and fro with every sweeping wind of doctrine, stable. So the psalmist elaborates even more in verse 2. He says, as the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people. What a great image. A geographical analogy of mountains surrounding physically and metaphorically the people of God. Jerusalem, if you ever go there and get a chance to take a tour there, one of the things you'll notice about the land is it's got a variety of topography. It does have mountains, it has hills, it has canyons, it has rivers, it even has snow-capped mountains, it has sea water. Israel is not the easiest place if you're an outside military to attack. You pretty much have to attack it by air because it's just not an easy place to navigate ground forces. Mountains surround Jerusalem. It's like its own protection. It's like David is saying, there's a divine, omnipotent mountain here when you come to the city. And that is the way, the psalmist says, that God is like a mountain for us. How is he like a mountain? Like a mountain, God is stable. Other than, and I'm not an expert on mountains, so I might be going outside a little bit of my scientific knowledge here, but I think you'll get the idea. Other than a volcano, mountains don't really change a whole lot. At least they don't seem to change a whole lot. Like a volcano can really change the look of a mountain. But how often do you go, say, to Colorado and see mountains have changed and they're 100 miles north now or 100 miles west? That just doesn't happen, right? I mean, those of you that go to the same place maybe every year in the Rockies can kind of depend on maybe that same campsite or that same crevice in a canyon that you love going to. There's stability, there's trust, there's dependence. That's one of the images that we have here coming out of these first couple of verses. God is like a stable mountain. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's also a secure place. So like a mountain, God is a security. He's a refuge. He's a strength. He's a supreme shelter. So God has a special way of caring for us as Christians. Let me ask a series of questions. These are rhetorical questions. You know the answer to these questions. How many times in history has the church or God's people been attacked and God's people lost to the evil one, ultimately? Has any Christian ever been lost to hell because the evil one snatched him away from God? Has God ever been unable to build his church? Has Jesus ever lost anyone to the evil one? Has the Holy Spirit ever been kicked out of one he was indwelling because the evil one decided to possess him? No, because the God that we are talking about this morning is a stable, secure God who is a refuge for all of us. Under his protection, we are safe. The psalmist says God surrounds his people with protection. And even verse 3, he says, the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land. All he's referring to there is there will be those who oppose God, those who oppose God's people, judging, seeking to remove them. The scepter of wickedness, it will not rest on the land. It will not make its home there, lest the righteous reach out their hands in iniquity. So unless we embrace the evil or say yes to the sin or the temptation to go away from God. The psalmist says here, not even that can do something about a stable, trustworthy God. Let me give you an example from somewhere else in the Old Testament of this idea in Jeremiah chapter 7. You're welcome to turn there if you'd like. I'm going to read some verses from Jeremiah chapter 7. Here is Jeremiah, and he is describing the condition of the land before captivity to Babylon. So he is a prophet speaking prophetically about what is to come, Babylonian captivity, and reminding them of what brought judgment on them. So this is a good example of verse 3. So God will protect you. He'll keep you from Babylon unless you reach out your hands to iniquity. And that's exactly what they did. That's what got them there. So Jeremiah speaks in verse 1 or verse 2. He says, "Stand in the gate of the Lord's house, proclaim there this word. Say, hear the word of the Lord, all you men of Judah who enter these gates." Here's what he says, "Amend your ways." He's warning them, repent. "Amend your ways, your deeds. I'll let you dwell here. I will allow you to stay here." So the idea is, if Babylon comes, I'll let you stay. You'll resist. You'll win if you change your sinful ways. Don't trust in these deceptive words that this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple like we'll hide behind this and not address our hearts. If you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice, if you do not oppress a sojourner, the fatherless, the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell here in the place that I give of old of your fathers forever. So again, fair warning. But behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. You're just listening to the world. You continue to listen to those worldly amusements and enticements that are cooling your affection for me. He says, behold, this is down in verse 11. I've seen this. Go to Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first. See what I did because of the evil of my people. But because you've done these things, when I spoke to you persistently, you didn't listen. When I called you, you did not answer. Therefore, I will do to this house that is called by my name, in which you trust, to the place that I gave to you and your fathers. He says, I'm going to cast you out of my sight in verse 15. You keep reading, and I encourage you to read through the rest of that chapter. So again, a fair warning. God is trustworthy. He's stable. He's secure. He's a refuge, and you can bank on that every single time unless you choose the world. Unless you choose to listen to something else, then there's no boundary. There's no fence. There's no protection. You might end up in some kind of metaphorical captivity outside of God's graces. See, a God truster has a stable life. Stable in prayer, stable in obedience, knowing the God that he serves. But one of the ways you can cultivate this is by being a student of history. And I don't necessarily mean just world history, church history, biblical history. Have a number of things in your mind that you can recall that are examples of God's faithfulness. So the minute you are tempted to think God is not in control and what he ordained is wrong, have that list in your head that you can go to. Nope, I've seen him faithful here. I've read about him being faithful there. I remember he was faithful to this friend. I remember how he was faithful to myself or my kids. As I said, recalling the works of God, recalling history can be a great way to cultivate certainly your prayer life. And let's go back to some of the things I mentioned at the beginning: anxiety, worry, fear. Why do those things happen? Why do those things come? Why do those things get to the point where they can even paralyze us? It's because we're failing to apply truthfully the knowledge that God is sovereign and faithful to those circumstances that have disrupted us. So we're thinking about the what ifs. We're thinking about all the possible directions this can go. So we're thinking about the what and not the who. Who's ordained what? And is it right? Trusting God results in a stable life. It also results in a sanctified life, a holy life. Really just, you could restate it. If you are if you're faithful to obey the Lord, you see growth in your life. Sanctification is working well. I can probably guarantee you that your trust in God is also deepening. It's also growing. They work together. He says, do good, O Lord, to those who are good and to those who are upright. What does upright mean? People of integrity, people addressing their heart. Integrity is the idea of wholeness. I mean, so when you talk about being upright, you're talking about being whole. So imagine a ball. If I had a ball in my hands right now, a very round ball, no crevices, no dents, just perfectly round. It wouldn't matter which way I turned it. It would always look like a ball. That's the picture of wholeness, upright, integrity. You could put a person in the emergency room or a labor room or taking a final for a school or a football game or wherever, and they are whole. They are the same. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good, to those who are whole, to those who are upright. And there is a contrast to that person who is obedient, who is a person of integrity, who's sanctified, to the one who isn't. That's the verse 5 contrast. As for such as turn aside, those who are crooked, those who are not whole, they are warped. The Lord shall lead them away with workers of iniquity. The Lord will allow them their choice, their will, and maybe as a part of judgment, you could say, they'll get what they deserve. They walk away from him. It's almost like your options are you can trust God or not trust God. And if you don't trust God, God's going to show you the consequences of not trusting. So the anxiety will get worse. And if you take medication for that, you might end up upping the medication to try to fix it. Psalm 86, verse 2 says, preserve my life, for I am godly. Save your servant who trusts in God. You are my God. The only reason someone has the confidence to say before God, I am godly, would be if he knows he's regularly seeking after the Lord in the first place. He's regularly living a life of obedience in the first place. Someone who trusts God is sanctified, being sanctified, living a sanctified life, an obedient life. And he's seeing the fruits, the evidences of that holy life. And so it's just, one feeds the other. So obedience feeds the prayer life, and the prayer life feeds obedience. And those things produce a trust in God. But it also results in what we might call a serene life, a peaceful life. But why would the psalmist say or make this final petition, peace be upon Israel? And I have no problem saying this probably has multiple meanings, even all at once. I think the lesser meaning is probably what some might just rush to, and that is that he's praying for national or international peace. I wouldn't say that's not out of the ballpark of what he's praying for. I mean, we're already talking about things surrounding Jerusalem and having protection there, both metaphorically and physically, it would make sense to pray for that kind of peace. But again, let's remember the context of this psalm. It's not about military. It's not warfare. This is not a chapter about, tactics of war and mindsets of war. It's about trusting God. That's an internal, personal experience. So it's not just national or international peace, but it's also praying for the peace of the hearts of the people who worship God, who follow after God. So tranquility and calmness in the soul. Peace has been defined as the presence of quiet goodness in one's life. Can you say you've had that experience? When you got that bad news, maybe via email or on a phone call from a friend, their marriage is about to end, discovered unfaithfulness in a spouse, they're ready to throw in the towel, they don't know what to do, they're panicking, they're upset, they're weeping. Maybe you got the same kind of news. Peace is a quiet goodness. It doesn't mean we celebrate sin, certainly not. But it does mean that when we have these kinds of evil disruptions in our life, that we, again, default back to the truth. Who is ordaining all this? And is it right? Who has created the world? Who has not just allowed choices and will and evil itself to go, but has sovereignly in control of all of it? And as Romans 8 says, is continuing to work all things together for good. St. Augustine rightly said, our hearts are restless until they find rest in thee. Another way of saying that is, you will be anxious as long as you do not find trust in God. When Jesus prays for his disciples in John chapter 14, one of the things he prayed for was peace. The same kind of peace that the psalmist is praying for here. Again, let's think back again and contrast trusting the Lord with what the world tells us is worthy of our attention. So when we want to forget about troubles, the world says try sexual pleasure. Try getting drunk. Try scrolling incessantly through social media. Eventually, you'll forget the troubles of the world. They'll go away. In short, try things that don't work. Try things that will burn. God says, through his word, a multiple, plethora, impossible amount of times, through every book of the Bible, no, I am worthy of trust. I am worthy of reliance. And as we said at the very beginning with our key point, that most tangible expression of trust is prayer. So this is really the application, the main application, or the main examination, I guess I should say, of this message is thinking about our prayer lives. Thinking about not just the frequency of them, but the habitual nature of them. The kinds of things we're talking to God about. This would be a great summer to give attention to your prayer life. I feel like that's a weakness, and I think most Christians probably would say, I don't pray as often as I should. I don't think about praying as often as I should. I've told people I'd pray for them, and I forget about it. I mean, we all have weaknesses in our prayer life we could work on. And there's some really decent resources. One, I will just say, by way of kind of announcement, or banking on announcement, in the summer studies this summer, one of the books that's going to be available for you ladies to go through is a book called The God Who Hears. It's my favorite book on prayer. There are many good books on prayer, but W. Bingham Hunter, and he writes a lot about, really, he kind of takes it from the perspective of not just the logistics of praying, but really the motivations to do it. Why do we think God is worthy to hear a petition? What is it about his nature that makes him capable of answering prayer at all? In other words, it's really about the idea of why praying to God has value. I've thought a lot about this in recent weeks and a number of other kinds of struggles in the Christian life. But if you really struggle with the spiritual disciplines in general, prayer being one of them, maybe the reason isn't because you don't know how to journal or don't know how to make a prayer request sheet or don't know when to pray. Maybe it's because you simply don't understand or realize the value of praying. If you struggle with praying, maybe start there. Because I really believe that we will always make time for things we value. If you value something, you'll sacrifice a lot of cows to get there. So start there. Think about why prayer is valuable. Why God is worthy of praying to. I told you at the beginning I was going to come back to this quote from Jerry Bridges in his book, Trusting God. Let me put that quote I gave you in its context now. He says in his book, I will say this next statement as gently and compassionately as I know how, and here's the quote I gave you. Our first priority in times of adversity is to honor and glorify God by trusting him. He says, we tend to make our first priority the gaining of relief from our feelings of heartache or disappointment or frustration. I'm not going to make you raise your hand, but how many of us do that? God, I don't like this, get me out of it. I don't want to be sick anymore. I need a new job. He says, rightly, we tend to make that our first priority. It's a natural desire, he says, and God has promised to give us grace sufficient for our trials and peace for our anxieties, referring to 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and Philippians 4, 6 and 7. But just as God's will is to take precedence over our will, Jesus himself said, yet not I as I will, but as you will. So God's honor is to take precedence of our feelings. Do you understand what he just said there? Our will is to get out. God's will may be for you to remain there a little bit longer, to walk through something with God. We honor God by choosing to trust him when we don't understand what he's doing or why he's allowed some adverse circumstances to occur. As we seek God's glory, we may be sure that he has purposed our good, that he will not be frustrated in fulfilling that purpose. So there's the great thing about it. While we would say God does not waste pain, it also means that God's purposes for you when things are not going right will not be frustrated by anything or anyone else. So whatever that sanctifying, redemptive purpose is, he'll make it happen. Isn't that good? Doesn't that make him worthy of trust? How often are you going to God in prayer like that? How often are you loving God enough to say, God, I don't understand why this is happening. Help me. Refocus where my loves should be, where my affections should be. I mean, taking the words of the psalmist, Psalm 139, verse 23 and 24, search me and know me, try me, study me. See if there's any wicked way in me anywhere. Lead me in a different path, an everlasting path, the psalmist says. That's some God-trusting prayer. We don't always know the answers to why things happen. I mean, I'll never, in a setting like this, at a bedside, a deathbed, at a funeral, I will never tell you all the reasons why God does the way he does. I don't know. None of us know. But he never seeks to tell us either. He does seek to reveal himself to us. He does seek to reveal his character to us, which makes him worthy of trust, which makes him worthy of praying to and seeking his face in. Father, it's good to be reminded of these truths because we are often weak, often fail in our attempts to navigate through trials and circumstances that are not nice, not kind. We do selfishly want to remove ourselves from struggle because we don't like it. It's frustrating. We perceive it as unhelpful. We perceive it as disruptive from our plans for the day or the week or the month or the season of our life. And we fail too often, as Bridges warns us, to think about the redemptive purposes that you have for us in those moments, in those seasons. Lord, we need to grow in our dependence upon you in prayer. We need to expand and deepen our affection for the conversation that is prayer, loving it more as the psalmist demonstrates to us over and over again, making it more and more of a default, not just when things are bad, but when things are good, when things are just the way they are. Will you help us, Lord, to do that? Will you help us to see how we can become better at the discipline of prayer, growing in it, maturing in it, teaching it to others, modeling it for our kids and our grandkids. May you allow us to expand, not just for our own sanctifying purposes, the benefit of others around us. Thank you for your word. Thank you for showing us an example of what it means to trust you this morning. Lord, as we return to a song that we have begun to learn this morning, may it resonate maybe in a fresh way the next time around as we think about the worthiness of who you are, the worthiness of what your son has done for us on the cross. We thank you for music and we thank you for songs to sing. We ask for your glory as we sing them to you in Christ's name.